You're listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to trash since 1977.
This roast beef.
All right, everybody, welcome to the GGTMC. You might want a little horsey sauce on that roast beef there. All right,
where's that Arby's reference?
Yeah, that's right, a little horsey on there. I didn't even know if that would fly up in the Great White North. That Arby's reference.
The winters are cold. The horsey sauce keeps us hot.
That's right. Keeps some sinuses clear.
Yeah.
So you can smell that roast beef. Take it how you want to take it. So
take that. I'll take it any way I can get it.
at this point, after nearly 20 years of marriage, I'll take it however I can get it, too. All right.
The horsey sauce.
Is Todd there?
Yeah.
He's face deep in the horsey sauce. Yeah,
evidently.
My right hand is numb, but not from what you think.
A little horsey saucing over there. Yeah. Straight horsey saucing out the...
Yeah, straight horsey saucing, son.
Out of PA there, Brad.
Pro tip.
Living that horsey sauce life up in the PA, up in the Keystone State.
Oh, man. All right, so welcome back. We are here, and we're going to talk about some movies. That's what we do every week. We basically have become... Now that I realize it, there's still a lot of podcasts out there that still cover old films, but I noticed that I don't get a lot of those referred to me anymore on my podcast apps or anything. So I'm starting to wonder if, you know, are we a revisionist podcast at this point, or are we looking back?
Postmodern. Yeah. Postmodern.
Yeah. Are we looking into the past a lot? You know, are we a historical podcast at this point? We might be historical. At this point.
Well, I think that would be anything from 2000 on, so 2000
yeah.
back.
Well, yeah,
at this point.
Which is madness.
Yeah, for my son's generation, yeah, it would be anything from last week.
Sure.
Sometimes I wonder. It's like, wow, you moved on quick. This week we were talking The Hitchhiker from 1953, directed by Ida Lupino, and Rad from 1986, directed by the one and only Hal Needham. So, which is crazy. I looked through Hal Needham's filmography and. You know, pound for pound, I enjoy a lot of Hal Needham films.
Oh, hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
I'm not going to say he's a master, but man, he made a lot of entertaining movies.
He's master of his own domain.
Yeah.
Yes.
Made a lot of entertaining movies, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I like the majority of them. I'll put it that way.
Same.
So we'll get into that in a little bit. Let's get into what we've been watching. Defer to you guys. I can flat tell you right now, I watched nothing else. I had a really busy week. In the workplace and outside the workplace. So I was able to cram these puppies in Friday and Saturday. Luckily, they were both pretty short films. So
yeah.
But I did not watch anything. So I defer to you guys. Go ahead.
Alrighty.
Todd, you want to roll?
All right. I went and watched The Psychic Killer or Psychic Killer 1975. Which is one of those ones that I had read about for a long, long time, hadn't seen, finally caught up with it. And it has, it's a movie. It's directed by Ray Danton. I believe Graydon Clark not only has a part in it, but I believe he was a writer on it. And it's not great. It's like a folding laundry sort of movie. It does have Julie Adams, she of Creature. Still looking, you know, quite MILFy in her early 40s, I guess, or maybe mid 40s.
Roast beefy.
She's very roast beefy. I the horsey on that. Am I doing it right? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think you are, but you might want to be careful.
Like I said, right hand numb. So yeah, it's okay. It's nothing to write home about, but it's okay. I caught Sidney Lumet's Prince of the City.
Oh yeah.
From 1981, Mr. Treat Williams and a whole slew of character actors who would wind up on some form or another of Law and Order.
Yeah. Some type of cop show, yeah.
Yeah. And I liked it. I can't say that I loved it, but I did like it. I think that part of the that I never was 100% able to follow exactly what was going on, and it seemed like the Treat Williams character kind of yo-yos between really, really public about what he's doing and really, really wanting to hide it from everybody while everybody knows about everything that he's doing. And that didn't make sense to me. Maybe I wasn't watching it closely enough. I don't know. So yeah, I just kind of, it drew me out of it because I was never 100%. So yeah, no, I like that one. I would definitely revisit that. Of course, I would have to have the time to revisit that.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, Prince of the City, good stuff. And then I caught one that is very, very indebted to the spaghetti western, amongst other things, and it's in A Valley of Violence. To them,
the acting's
definitely.
Good.
Oh, sorry.
The acting. I was surprised at how good the acting was.
Yeah, no, it's solid. It's solid all the way around. But yeah, I mean, it's you know, there's some unexpected twists in there here and there, especially the way the finale sorts itself out. And it looks fantastic. And so, I mean, one of the things that I know was kind of odd for people who saw it is that the there's like no extras in the town, so yeah. It's like a population 9 yeah. Town, yeah. Which is just really, really weird.
Yeah.
It really so makes there's
it feel,
that
makes it feel low budget, which you know.
It yeah, is. It really does. You really feel the budget on that end of it.
Yeah.
But there's some, you know, it's a great little story. It's basically, well, I won't give away the biggest influences I think are on it. But yeah, no, I would definitely recommend that for anybody who and wants to see something a little more modern.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would skip it for probably for the fact that John Travolta lately has picked turd after turd,
yes.
He's surprisingly good in it.
Yeah, no, he is. He is. Everybody is, like I said, everybody.
Yeah.
Ethan Hawke.
Ethan Hawke's good. The dog is very good.
The dog. Jesus, give him that cat an Oscar.
Yeah.
The kid
that plays the heavy is, I can't remember his name, but he's really
James
good.
James Ransone?
Yeah. So he kind of reminds you of one of Will's favorites, Milo Ventimiglia or Ventimiglia?
A little bit,
but he's...
but he, you had me until that.
Yeah, well, no, but he plays the sad sack kind of, and Larry Fessenden.
Yeah, he shows up.
Larry Fessenden's very fun. He's a lot of fun in the movie.
Yep.
So it's as a modern Western, a very simple modern Western. I think it's 90 minutes, right? 80 minutes, 80 mm-hmm. something minutes. It works very well. It's not going to blow your socks off, but
no,
it's surprisingly good.
No, but it was pretty damn good. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
And then I went from that over to Mr. Jordan Peele's Us.
Oh, yeah.
And I watched that, and I liked that one a good bit, too.
Yeah.
It definitely has some major problems, I think. Unless there was stuff I missed.
I don't know.
What's the biggest problem? Because I agree, I think it is flawed. But
it is, it is flawed. I'll agree with that, too.
The biggest problems are twofold. Number one... the explanation that it gives for the villains doesn't make sense. in the sense that they act the opposite of what they're saying. I don't want to give it away, but yeah, I just found that really, really odd. The movie sets up a set of rules and then doesn't consistently play by them.
Yeah,
is the way that I would frame it. Number one, number two, I think that the final reveal just doesn't. fully make sense, although it is satisfying. I think there's strong performances across the board. It looks fantastic. I think Peele is a director who has a ton of talent behind the camera. Mm-hmm. He just needs to tighten up his writing a little bit. I love these genre movies, horror genre movies specifically, that are not tied into being about ghosts and zombies, is basically everything else in the genre that you see today that hits the multiplex screens. And I like that he doesn't do that. He goes, left the field. He does stuff that you wouldn't normally. So I give him a lot of credit for that. And I think he's got a lot of room to grow and blossom even further than he already has. I'm definitely interested in the stuff that he does. This one is better than Get Out. I'll put it that way, as far as I'm concerned. He's still got a little ways to go. But he's doing some good. He's doing very good work. Yeah. So kudos to him.
Still a really good one. Really good 1-2 punch of Get Out and Us, I'd say.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And pretty original, right? He makes well-made, cerebral, ambitious films, even if they don't quite stick the landing.
I absolutely agree with that. Yeah. Like I said, he's doing stuff that's not vampires, run zombies, and ghosts. Yeah.
So also, there's effort.
Yeah. I also like that. Get Out's a little different, but I also like with Us that he's commenting on race a little bit without actually ever really hitting you over the head by commenting on race.
Well, I think he's commenting a little. He is doing that more expansively than that, though. Yeah. I think he's talking more about the culture in generally white, black, or Latino, black, or whatever you want to say.
Yeah. That's a really
good. And I like that too.
Really good family portrayal in that film.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the dynamic is good.
Yeah. And again, what's her name? Naya Lupito? Is it not? It's
Lupita
not
Ida Nyong'o?
Yeah, Lupita Nyong'o, not Ida Lupino. her performance as both characters is pretty.
Well, everybody's dual performance is
good.
Yeah, the guy that played the I can't remember the name of that character in Black Panther, but he was that guy. But man, he's really good as the goofy dad, with the bad dad jokes, and as this kind of savage character.
Yep.
Yeah, he's really good.
He is really, really good. And the kids are good, man.
The kids are quality for sure, which is tough because I think all of us have seen enough evil seed films where we just kind of roll our eyes like, fuck off. Like, but the kids felt like feral, and there was like a real genuine threat with the kids.
Oh, absolutely. Especially the little girl. Holy shit. Was that creepy?
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that sound. They just make that noise and everybody just starts moving. I love that, man.
Yeah. So there was that. And I believe that's all that I got for this past week. Kick it over to you, Will.
Okay. I got a few things, not a ton of stuff, but did I talk about Friday the 13th, Part 8? I think I did.
Yeah.
Yes.
Manhattan, yep.
Yeah. What else did I watch?
Friday the 13th.
I didn't watch a ton, actually. Wow, I thought... before I forget, I think, Sammy, you had caught that series. I think it's called Losers on Netflix. Was it you that had caught that or no?
Was it me?
It was not me.
Is it the sports thing?
Yes.
No, I didn't catch it. I wanted to catch it. I didn't catch it, though.
Okay, so I watched a couple episodes of that, and I can't recommend it enough. I think it's really fantastic. I'd actually put it on hoping William would be kind of drawn to it just because he's very competitive. He's not a poor winner or a poor loser, but...
But losing's hard, right?
Nobody. Losing's hard. So I wouldn't say he's a poor loser, but, there's times where one of the big lessons is, lose with some grace, right?
Yeah.
But it's really good. I think as you don't have to be a sports fan to appreciate any of these. Some are done with more of a humorous touch. Some are done with a more kind of more sort of philosophical about life. But all of them look at how people have handled losing and sort of the embarrassment and the humiliation at the most significant, potentially life-changing moment in their lives. And I think it's fascinating as a character piece looking at that. So I've seen a couple of them, and I really enjoyed them. So I'm going to continue watching them. So anyone who wants to see something that, if that sounds interesting, it's on Netflix. It's I got to say, kudos to them. Their original content keeps getting better and better. In some fronts, but then again, not even they make is for me. So
yeah,
I was watching some show called The Island or something. I don't know, The Island or something.
I don't know.
It's pretty.
There's
terrible,
so much stuff out there.
There is.
I was telling Todd this before a few months back. There's just so much stuff out there. You know, you have to almost pick things one at a time and just kind of go through them because, I mean, there's just too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Otherwise, really you just lose track of everything. Yeah.
You do. You're lost in the sea. Watched Frankenstein's Monsters, Monster Frankenstein, which.
What the hell?
Probably. Yeah, it's David Harbour.
Okay. I know what it is. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And it's David Harbour. It's David Harbour doing Orson Welles' F for Fake in a way.
That's on Netflix too, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So I have a great affection for David Harbour being a Stranger Things fan. And he's really doing the Welles thing. Like there's some moments when it's basically he's looking back at his quote unquote father, who made televised, TV, made for TV plays. So it's, I guess it's, who is that filmmaker that did like Best in Show and
Christopher Guest.
Yeah, it's almost like a little Guesty too, right? So, but no, it's like 35 minutes long. It was a laundry folding endeavor. So yeah, so it's good enough. Then I did a documentary and the name is going to fail me now. I'm going to look it up as we're talking. I want to say it's called like 306 Hollywood or something, or I'm going to muck it up. Oh, it is 306 Hollywood. Mine's not. I got it right. All the fish oil capsules and crossword puzzles are working. this documentary I caught on, see, ironically, I tripped myself up there. It was for platform, but man, I'm bad. So this was...
is it on Canopy?
Yes, Canopy, exactly. I was on the tip of my tongue. So I'll just summarize this so I don't have to stumble through it. It's a documentary. So when a brother and sister undertake an archaeological excavation of their late grandmother's house, they embark on a magical, realist journey in search of what life remains in the objects that are left behind. Mm. So it's a little precious for its own good. As you might even be able to glean from the synopsis, but it is, I think there's some good stuff in there. So this brother and sister were very close with their grandmother. She passes away and they look at objects in her house, whether it's her tendency to collect pennies in old tin Band-Aid containers or a number of things. And just kind of lamenting how when someone goes, everything in that house is kind of, that's someone's life and the life they've lived and now it's all gone and the ripple effect it has on those impacted. And it looks at a few different experts in a few different fields as well. But they spend a year kind of going through his house and recounting stories. And they do that thing where they find some audio recordings and they reenact it with actors. And yeah, it's interesting. I think its heart is in the right place, but it's a little bit precious for its own good. So... yeah,
I've noticed that Canopy's starting to release stuff theatrically now. Like they're starting.
Are
to
they
throw
really?
Their, yeah, they're starting to throw their names out there on documentaries that are coming out. So
they're
good,
great.
Good for them.
Listen, I can't recommend them enough. They got a ton of Criterion stuff. Again, I'll say it every few weeks just because it's free. You through your library. You just have to check and see if your library partakes or your school. Like if you were at a university or a college. There's a ton of great stuff, a ton of great documentaries, foreign films, film festival films. It's a great resource. So that's it, man. I haven't watched a ton this week. I was telling Totter off the air, I was at a Brazilian steakhouse last night where they just feed you copious amounts of meat.
Yes.
And I'm dying right now, man.
Yeah. Yeah, oh. Man. It's one of the places like where they walk around just with meat and they just kind of like throw it on. Yeah. 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 I've been
shaving
one of those
it off and throw it in your face. And
yeah, man. Yeah. And at first you're like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
And then about halfway through, you're like, holy shit, this is too much.
The heart starts. Ever. Yeah. Until it's not.
Until it's not. Exactly.
Yeah. Everyone starts breathing heavy and lots of regret. They see the
you have to start patting the your top lip off because it's just meat coupled sweat.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's rough.
Yeah, the meat sweats. That's right.
I got the meat sweats right now. It's terrible. But that's how it goes.
All right. All right, though, that's everything we've watched. Like I said, unfortunately, I didn't get involved much this week, but that happens. We'll see if I can play catch up next week. All right, we'll take a short break, come back, and I guess we'll go chronological like we always do. I guess we'll touch base on The Hitchhiker from 53. Right. We'll be back right after this. Toronto reference. You hear it in that song there. Smoking some hash through a pin there in Toronto.
That's living that Toronto life.
It's, it is. Straight Torontonian there.
That's how we do.
that safety pin behind the ear.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So our first film is, and I'm caught with my pants down again, The Hitchhiker from 1953. And this is directed by Ida Lupino. And my main reason for choosing it is that she was directing movies back in a time when women directors weren't really a big thing.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because there were a lot of female screenwriters.
Yes.
Back then, and certainly ones who worked behind the scenes in a more creative capacity. But she was one of the more prominent female directors, if not one of the, well, I mean, there were people before her, obviously. There was Lois Weber, I think was the first American female director.
Yeah.
But Lupino, she was an actress, and so she played in a number of films noir, so she understood what made them tick, and she grasped how to translate that from behind the camera.
Yep.
I would argue that she was kind of like a latter day Catherine Bigelow in a lot of ways.
I think that's a pretty accurate statement.
Yeah. She made,
and I like her. I like her output because it's very, it is very genre related. So it appeals to me.
Yeah.
And she's solid, man. She's rock solid behind the camera.
She's, I know Scorsese's a big fan and a few other filmmakers are big fans. She's was working in genre and stuff when, again, like I say, I think maybe that might be the better way to put it. There were female directors, but she was, it sounds like a funny thing to say now, but she was playing, a man's game in a woman's body. Like she was not afraid to jump in there be a part of, and she thought she had something to say. And I think she did too. She was a good actress and an interesting filmmaker. And I agree. Mm-hmm. Her output, if you go back and look at some of the films she directed, they're very interesting. There's a good rape drama out there called Outrage that's really good. The Bigamist is kind of fun. I mean, there's some good stuff out there. So definitely check out some more Ida Lupino. But we're going to talk about The Hitchhiker. It was on the Criterion Channel, so we'll get into that now. Plot synopsis. Two fishermen pick up a psychotic escaped convict who tells them that he intends to murder them when the ride is over. And that's a very simple plot, and it's a very simply made movie. Which is also part of the reason why I chose it, because I always find it interesting when you strip away almost everything and just take it right down to the basics of the narrative. And that's what this film is. Awful easy to hitch a ride back in the 50s, as the movie shows. but this is we did The Hitcher not too long ago. Now we're doing The Hitchhiker.
I don't know. We've also done Hitchhike with Franco Nero.
Yeah. Man, there's going to be so much confusion on this.
Yeah, so we've done some hitchhiking movies. We've been there, done that. So I don't know who wants to lead on this.
I could if you don't want to.
Okay, go for it then, TA.
Sound good?
TC.
Yeah. TA, TC.
TA, ooh. That, what the hell were they? TAs.
TNA, that's what we call it.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
That's right.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. So my best friend growing up, his dad was a truck driver, and every time we'd be watching movies, he'd come in the room and going, "You guys watching that tits and ass shit again?" We'd be like, "We wish, man."
Yeah, no kidding.
Just the tits, please.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, right? Hey, you know. anywho, so the opening is all business, right? The Myers character kills his way through a couple of drivers. And, you know, Lupino, she shoots it all very mysteriously. It's nothing but like extremities and shadows. Very, very evocative. It isn't until our protagonists pick up the villain that we see more of him than just his hands and feet. And even though he's like cloaked in darkness in the back of the car, when he thrusts his face out into the light, so we first, you know, see him, it's very startling. You know, Tallman, the guy who played him, who was William Tallman, you know, he had a very distinctive look to him, and even more so here. This was based on the crime spree of Billy Cook, and the film starts out with the text telling us that all this is factual. Now, Billy Cook, from what I was able to find out, his mom died and his dad left the kids in an abandoned mine. Or was that in the film? I don't remember 100%. No, that was the Billy Cook story.
Yeah.
So you could see where this guy's life was headed. And so it did. And he even had a deformed eye that Lupino, I think, puts to marvelous use here. The Myers character is, you know, he's belligerent. He hates humanity. He's a pure villain. He's sort of like, going back just a few minutes ago, he's sort of like Hauer, Rutger Hauer in The Hitcher, but he's way more blunt. Yeah. He has a very, very clear goal. I think that our two protagonists, which is played by, who's that, Edmund O'Brien and Frank Lovejoy, they, when we first introduced them, I think they start off kind of oddly. They're just kind of drifting around, and they say they're looking for a fishing hole.
two guys riding around looking for a hole.
I know, hey, right?
Listen,
the illusions are I was almost saying the illusions are queer, but I was actually going to say the illusions are clear.
No, they're very clear to me. I think they say it, and again, maybe it's the age we're in. Things were a little different back then, but I couldn't help but think that there was allusions to them being lovers.
Yeah, there are
several instances, right? Yeah, I mean, even right, the end of the film, and
I mean, I had the same thought. I don't know if it's the time we're in or not, or I don't know if it's the fact that we watch so many genre movies that that's what we wanted. But
yeah,
but
yeah,
I mean,
stick something in a pole.
Yeah, there's no doubt that. I mean, they're leaving their families to go fishing. You know, there's a.
And they lied about where they were going.
Yeah, I just had a little. There's just a scent of Brokeback Mountain in there. Just a,
oh, yeah, yeah.
A slight tinge.
Well, but I think, but more than that, we get the sense that they're kind of lost in life. They're looking for something to live for, and part of that might be because of
each
you know.
Other.
Yeah, exactly. They're just kind of like, well, we can't really you know tell anybody about this, but at the same time.
Well, yeah. And the Tallman character says that, you know, you look at you guys, you're slaves or something like that. Or,
yeah.
You know, you're working, you got a mortgage, you got families, you don't, you know, and once you commit to that lifestyle, as Will and I can flat tell you, you are in some degree, you are, you know, at that point, you're part of the system. And
oh, yeah.
You can either be part of the system or you can, I don't know, go out into the woods and live like a hippie, but I don't really want to raise my kids that way. It's just my personal preference. So yeah, I'm a bit of a, for lack of a better word, I'm a slave to the system. It is what it is. And I think that she's basically kind of telling that story. And then I don't know, man, I don't know. I'm glad I'm not the only one who thought that that their friendship was maybe slightly tighter than fishing buddies.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's so weird. It's so, Well, think about this for a second. Who says that they're going to go fishing and doesn't have some idea where they're going?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, they're literally just driving around the California desert looking for a place to go fishing. Yeah. Who does that?
Well, then nobody. They make a point to say you lied to your families about what you were doing and everything else. And there's just some lingering shots with them and look and the concern with each other. And it's a little bit more tender than you typically see.
Yeah.
Especially in this time.
Yeah. Especially. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think we're reading too much into it. I think I would be willing to bet you if we could sit Ida Lupino down and ask her, she'd probably give a coy smile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's also you can look even deeper. I mean, maybe they were going to Mexico for the reason that, you know, I think in America in the 50s, if you got caught even in the woods, you know, having a little fun with your best buddy, it might not go over that well. I think it's illegal. But maybe in Mexico, you know, all bets are off.
That's right.
Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know.
I don't know. We might be reading too much into that, or
maybe.
But either way,
listen. I do think this film has actually gotten some traction as being what's the expression I'm looking for? Like a homoerotic, or not homoerotic? I can't think of the words I want to use to. Be clear about it.
I think I know. I think I know, but I don't know the word.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I know exactly what I want to say. I just cannot think of the damn words right now. It is too early in the morning for this. So the Myers character, he's constantly looking for ways and reasons to belittle our two protagonists, Gil and Roy. There's that great watch scene where he tells them that he had a watch like Gil's when he took it. You know, he's always calling them suckers and so on. And he's always seething about his past, but he's got the gun, right? He's got the gun. It gives him power. It evens the playing field. And the two guys ask him if he's ever been on the other side of it, and he says, you know, no, you know, of course not. He couldn't cut it, right? It's weakness, not strength. And that's kind of the thing about the Myers character in general, is that he's kind of. He's menacing, but you could tell that there's this kind of whiny sad sack inside him.
Yes.
That's just like kind of raging to get out. Kind of like the stuntman Mike at the end of Death Proof, in a way.
Well, yeah, and I think you see someone who's been put upon so often in his life that he's going to revel at any opportunity to be in the other chair. And it almost it does become very spiteful, and he does get joy out of it, because, you know, as he talks about and throughout the film, he's had a pretty shitty life, and he's gonna dole some bullshit out whenever possible.
Yeah, absolutely. He's also Myers is the worst backseat driver in the history of cinema.
Yes.
The worst,
man. Even when they're not driving.
Yeah, right.
Get out of the car, do this. Open that can.
Hurry up. Yeah.
He's the worst backseat everything.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
The film, as these films tend to do, introduces a very bland G-Man character and this subplot of the manhunt for Myers. But, you know, I think that clearly we and Lupino are not really all that interested in this, because it's not that interesting. And it usually isn't in these sort of things. Though, yeah. I guess back in the 50s, people either wanted that, or the motion picture production code mandated it, I guess.
Yeah.
And a lot of these things, just so you know, they could say, well, you know, crime doesn't pay. Look at our boys are out there, you know, doing everything they can.
Yeah. Well, the G-Man character is very brief. I think is it only one scene with the actual G-Man?
No, there's a couple. Well, with the actual G-Man, I think it's maybe two.
Yeah.
Two, maybe three. But
and then she kind of puts Mexican police officers kind of at the forefront, which is also a nice touch, because, again, in the 50s, Mexicans were pretty much used as banditos pretty much all the time in movies.
Or gross caricatures.
Yeah.
But that said, you know, they do move along as quickly as possible with this subplot, so we can get back to the meat of the film. And these scenes also do give us little lulls to break up the tension, which is actually pretty smart, because I think that, you know, Lupino here is displaying some really fastidiously economical filmmaking, No scene is unnecessary or lasts longer than it has to. And that's really, you know, kind of the beauty of this film in general. And I would say, you know, I haven't seen tons and tons of Lupino's work, but from what I've seen, that's kind of been one of the things is, you know, she's very economical in the way that she does stuff. It's she understands what the film needs, and she gives it that. I think the desert locales work. A lot of the film truly looks like the middle of nowhere. It's just rocks and sand and dust. And that really kind of, you know, that brings in the feeling that these guys are truly screwed because there's nowhere to go for help anywhere out there. And even after they get to the town, right, they're still fucked. The film just, you know, it doesn't cut anybody a break. And it still has that, you know, sort of fatalism running through it. And that you would get in you know, films more and all that. And you kind of suspect that Myers knows this. He's as desperate as the two protagonists are, but he's got the gun. So he's the one in charge. Let's see here. Okay. So yeah. When we get to the ending, the Myers reaction is very, very primal. When they slap the cuffs on him, he just fucking loses it. He even spits a little bit of blood at one of the characters. And it's an ending that's not quite what I expected. And, you know, somehow I think it was a little bit of a letdown. Because yeah, I think I was expecting something a little more dramatic and maybe even violent than what we get. Although there is a nice little bit there of violence that gets thrown in.
I mean, I could be wrong, but did somebody throw a chop? I almost feel like
there's a few gun butts and a few chops.
I thought there was a couple chops. Yeah,
not Shatnerian chops, but you know, they're close.
Well, kind of like that chop in Bloody Iris, right?
Yes,
to the windpipe.
And that's I think that the film is really good, and it's a nice little underseen, I would say, or at least under discussed film, both from a director that I don't think gets as much love as she should.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's pretty much all the notes that I got. So. One of you guys wants to jump on in?
Will, you want to? You want me to?
I'll say a few quick things here. So, interestingly, this poster was voted, it's pretty well regarded. It's was voted 23 of the 25 best posters of all time. Which publication was that? No, I just read it, and I can't recall now, but it was a pretty well-regarded film publication. Additionally, this film was in public domain for a long time.
Yeah.
A lot of beat-ass prints going around and poorly edited and, you know, just one of those that unfortunately people probably didn't get a chance to see or appreciate. Even though it's maybe not a cinematic marvel in terms of its camera work, I think it is still well-made and cleanly shot, and a lot of the exteriors do look great. I think Lupino does a really good job, like you had said, Todd, with the exteriors and rock faces and the desert. It does really convey a sense of isolation and desperation.
Yeah. It looks, I mean, I like all that. The outdoor stuff looks all great. I mean, it does. It looks good. I always think to myself, you know, how does anybody know to go on these roads? I mean, even with maps, I mean, these roads, they feel they're just, you know, sand, dirt roads out in the middle of nowhere. I just don't know, you know, it's just odd to me, right? Like, I wouldn't even drive my car on, like, a dirt road at this point.
Yeah, no, I'm with you, man. I'm with you 100%. Well, I want to give it up to Lupino, too. She wrote the screenplay.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, she's good. What else do we got here? Well, we get Dot spinning newspaper.
Yep.
That's right. Got to have that.
That's great. Got to have that. Can I just mention something that's completely unrelated to anything, but it is very GGTMC. So William wanted to watch Beverly Hills Cop yesterday while we were folding laundry. So we threw it on. And do you remember we often talk about the convention of the fruit stand?
Yes.
Getting destroyed. So the fun one in that is there's a fruit truck that's loaded with fruit in a car chase that gets smashed up and the fruit goes everywhere and the vegetables. So that was a next level fruit stand smash. I had to give it up. I even said to him, William, you always see fruit stands, but you'll never see that again.
Yeah. It's very bizarre to me still to this day why fruit is such a hated thing in action movies.
Yeah, I know. Well, we get to see
nothing but raw meat.
The angel of vengeance when it comes to fruit is Mr. Majestic himself.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Oh, man. Yeah, no, it's true. I feel like one gripe I have with the film is I feel like the two leads or two protagonists, they almost make them, they're a little flat for my liking.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I don't know if underwritten is what I would say, but yeah, they're a little. I don't know. I don't think they have enough written into their characters to really root for them beyond sort of basic human decency.
That's kind of what it is. I think that the two sets of characters are such extremes. Mm-hmm. That I think it's kind of programmed that way.
Yeah.
So that we can see how bad this guy is. We have to show how ordinary people are.
Sure.
I think that's kind of what she was going for. I mean, yeah, these two guys could have used a little more
flourish,
a little more horsey. Yeah. A little more horse.
Yeah, they could have definitely used. But William Tomlin was taking all the horsey in this one.
Yeah,
he was.
Yeah, he got the majority of the horsey in this one. There's no doubt. I think that's the point of the movie in some ways. I agree with you. After a certain point, those characters hardly even talk.
They don't. They just give side glances and.
Yeah.
But I wonder too. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You got the two characters, Gil and Roy, right? And Gil's situated as kind of like the alpha in the relationship, but I think it's Roy who kind of grows
the top.
Roy's the power bottom. But it's Roy who kind of grows a pair and stands up to Myers once he's resigned that he's not going to live through this, right?
Yeah.
So Gil's quiet most of the time anyway. Mm-hmm. And you got to wonder, you know, is it because he knows talk won't help? I don't know, maybe. Or has he bowed down to Myers as being like the new alpha? You know, or is he biding his time? You're not 100% sure. And I think that's kind of, I think, where the blandness comes from, is because they're just giving nothing in the situation. So they're just kind of playing along with it. So it kind of works for me in a way. But at the same time, I get exactly what you're saying. They're not memorable characters.
No. And not that they necessarily need to be. But I think for the time, it didn't feel as much economy of character as it did, maybe a little underwritten. But again, I don't think that was the point, so I wouldn't take away too many points for that.
No.
Another one we did that sort of featured a hitchhiking, but kind of a kidnapping on the road, that probably my favorite of all the ones we've done is Rabid Dogs.
Yeah. Mm. So there's this. So watching this and all these hitchhiking movies we've watched over the years, 11 years of doing the show, there's something about the hitchhiking genre and sadistic tendencies that go hand in hand.
Cruelty.
I have no idea. Hitchhikers are so mean, man.
Oh man, they get a bum rap.
Yeah, they're such assholes.
Yeah, they get a real bum rap.
I couldn't help but think of Rabid Dogs and of course The Hitcher and all those films because Tallman is there's a sadistic streak in him. You get these little smiles. Maybe there's a sexual connotation with the fact that he sleeps with one eye open, like, you know, the one-eyed Willy or whatever you want to call it. You know, I don't know.
Sure. Well, yeah.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I'm just saying. I'm just speaking off the top of my head here. But
yeah.
It's weird, this kind of sadistic nature that's involved in all these hitchhiking movies. I mean, Rutger Hauer is eating the screen in The Hitcher.
Oh man.
George Eastman and the
Pissy.
Yeah. I mean, these characters are awful people.
And the one, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. It's all right.
The one face in the cars in all the films that refuses to have his scenery chewed up is Nero, man. He's like, fuck that. You're not eating my scenery, motherfucker.
That's right.
I'm gonna eat just as much as you.
And then you get to the end, and his wife does almost the entire scene nude, and you think, well, she just ate all the scenery.
Yeah.
Can't fight. You can't beat that, Franco. Sorry.
No. Yeah, you can. You know what's funny, too? I don't want to reveal it, but I felt like there was going to be a twist in this film. I think they said, you guys lied about, you know, or not even when you lied about where you were, but I just feel like that you know, maybe we've seen too many Shyamalan films or just twisty films at this point, but I just felt like the end, there was going to be a reversal of roles. And the two were going to overtake, and you were going to hear like a radio bulletin to say, you know, and all three have been captured, blah, blah, blah. Like almost like a Hitchcocky type thing, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, wrong man accused type thing. And Tommy gets it sets itself up that way by changing clothes and all that stuff.
Yeah. Tallman looks like sort of a love child of sorts of Joe Strummer and Belmondo to me. It's very, very strange, man. What else do we got? I like the scene with the shooting. That's a good tense scene, I think. Where they're shooting out in the desert and.
Pretty sure he shoots a dog at some point.
Yeah, he does shoot a dog.
Off screen.
Off camera.
Yeah,
of course,
off camera, yeah.
You don't even ever see the dog. It's just piped in, right?
Yeah, it keeps yapping. He just shoots a fucking thing.
Yeah, he's had enough of that fucking barking. But I got to say, too, wondering if this is Lupino looking at a role reversal, having these men be emasculated by this phallic object, right?
Yeah, I mean, you almost have to feel that. I mean, it's... There's definitely some emasculation going on here.
Absolutely, which I think, you know, was said to be intentional. She was this very savvy woman. I love the cinematography with this sort of the back of the truck camera work where it's the car is in front and it's they obviously had set up the camera rigged on the back of the truck and it was following ahead while the car was behind weaving around the roads.
Yeah.
Pretty good for the time. Mm-hmm. You know, those cameras weren't light. Tall man says he's 28. Dude looked 48. That hard 1950s living.
Yeah
right.
Yeah.
Red meat and booze.
Yeah, that's right. Cigarettes. I don't see him. There's no smoking in the movie, though, is there? I don't think about that.
That's a good point. Usually, films like this, they would have been just lighting them off each other.
Yeah.
Jeez. I thought it was a good... dramatic decision to refrain from them using subtitles during the Spanish-speaking scenes.
Yeah, that was interesting, wasn't it? You get everything you need right out of you know, the way that they're acting. You don't really need the subtitles, and she doesn't give you any like you would think that they would have, especially in a 1950s film where somebody's speaking another language.
Yeah, they'd bang you over that, but this gives us injects us into Tallman's neuroses a little bit by not having the subtitles. Mm-hmm. Right? So it works well. So it's again another nice little decision by her. What else? I'll tell you what, you know, we talked about the sound of the dogs. There was a brutal sound, sound effect in this, or not a sound effect, like a Foley, like a sound that was used for the vultures. It was like someone going, ah! Like it was someone just like gobbling or making like a seagull noise. It was brutal. The end. I love the boat, like the marina or the dock.
Yeah.
I think it's a really good spot for a finale. It gives us kind of a good sandbox, lots of wild cards that could come out from, you know, boats, equipment, hiding away. Really, I don't know. It really worked well for me in that respect. And I got to say, Tallman tries to do the Bud Spencer two-hand overhead smash on the Mexican police. Bad move if your name isn't Bud Spencer.
Yeah, right.
That's right.
So those are all my notes.
Yeah, that dock scene, that lighting on those old dock scenes, that old school lighting where you have one light bearing down, then it goes away, and then another light bearing down. It kind of gives you that light and shadow thing. It always plays out well. I don't know why that works, but it does.
Mm-hmm.
I only got a few things. At one point, the reporter says, well, I just caught my ear, and I couldn't help but to think to myself, it's such a crazy line to have in a movie. And the reporter says, this strange race against death. I'm like, I wonder if that was from the trailer or something. It's very strange.
It sounds like a tagline.
Yeah, I mean, really, the movie belongs to, you know, Lupino and the Tallman character. Really, it's all about the sadistic nature of the character. And maybe it is all about the emasculation. I don't know without looking into it a little bit deeper, but it certainly has more to do with just the sadism and the meanness. And like I said, there's a lot of, not a lot, but I guess there's a handful of scenes where the Tallman character is kind of smiling at him. Like he knows he's in power. He knows that these guys aren't what they say they are. At least he thinks they're not what they say they are. There's all these interesting like little things he does that, you know, you almost feel like it's coming from Lupino herself. Like it's kind of turning the movie on its ear a little bit with the damsel in distress. And in this case, you get the men in distress, you know, because these characters, yeah, they're fishermen, they're outdoorsmen and everything else, but they're not, you know, they're not, even if there is no homosexual type tinge there or even a small streak, they're not masculine characters. They're not the kind of guys that are looking to always, you know, fight their way out. There's a moment where they try to sneak away, but I think Tallman almost, you know, that's one of the moments where he smiles. I think he wants them to try to sneak away, right? Like he knows that there's nothing they can really do. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of sadism in the film is really what the movie's kind of all about. It's really just all about that kind of picking on these kind of two Hollywood leads in a way. And it's just it's an interesting touch. I mean, the 50s became kind of an era, too, where the bad guy kind of became a highlight of, you know, movie watching. Like, people would go to the movies to see Jimmy Cagney, or they would go to the movies to see the kind of semi-bad guy. You know, the character that kind of threw all the rules out the window and just lived life on its own. You know what I mean? And you started to see that in the 50s. It kind of really kind of grew more and more, and into the 60s and the 70s, of course, you know, you can be full on rebellion. But in the 50s, you know, these guys are living outside, like he says, you know, they're living in the system. He's living outside the system, and maybe Lupino's saying something about the system itself. Maybe this, living in the system is not the way you should live your life. I don't know. Again, kind of thinking off the top of my head there, but I do find it interesting.
No, that's a good point, man.
Yeah, the Tallman characters, you know, as terrible a character as he is and as terrible as the things he does, there's a level of freedom to letting him express himself in such sadistic nature. And again, I think that's one of the reasons why we go to the movies or we watch movies. I think one of the reasons why we're attracted to bad guys is because, and not all of us are, but let's just say, you know, I know that I am attracted to bad guys in movies, and it's probably because there's not a mean bone in my body. Like, I'm, mm-hmm. you know, I don't have that in me. So I'm attracted to that because there's a freedom to being that evil. There's a freedom mm-hmm. of not being judged. There's a freedom of power. There's all these things that kind of come out naturally in being a heavy. And, you know, I'm kind of attracted to that. And one of the reasons why, you know, I enjoy movies is in books and all kinds of stories is I love when you know, like, I can't remember who said the quote, but, you know, the bad guys don't think they're doing anything bad. They think they're doing something right. It's just, you know, obviously by society's nature, they're not doing everything right. You know, it's just, you know, you're an oddball character. So there's a bit of an underdogness to it all. And you could get into all that. And again, we're kind of bumbling our way through all this pathos that that we're trying to speak through. But I mean, it's there. It's clearly there. And I'm glad not the only one who thought that, you know, there is something a bit odd about our two leads. Our two leads are, they're going fishing, but they don't really know where they want to go fishing. And
they know where they want to go fishing.
Yeah, they kind of want to go to Mexico, and they kind of want to do this. And, you know, I mean, yeah, guys like to get away and just be guys sometimes, but there's a slight, you know, a slight little elbow nudge here. It's ever so slight. I mean, you really got to be looking for it in a way. So maybe the first time you see the film, you probably wouldn't even think it, maybe. Well, maybe you would. If you've seen enough movies, but I do like that it's very lean. There's not a lot going on as far as background characters and stuff. It pretty much stays with the three leads. There's a few things with a few Latino actors, and I like those moments. I like the moment with the little girl and all that kind of stuff. I like those little moments. I mean, they're nice little touches, and I never really understood why Frank Lovejoy's character can speak Spanish so well, but hey, you know, whatever. They're living in Southern California. It might, you know, I mean, it's quite possible, right? So, And also, I feel like, you know, the Edmund O'Brien character, you know, he's a mechanic, but I feel like he can't fix anything. Or maybe he's doing it on purpose. No. I don't know.
Yeah.
I felt like he was kind of useless as far as a mechanic goes. Wouldn't go to his garage nearby.
Oh, man.
But, yeah, I just think that sadism is quite key to, you know, obviously the films that are going to follow in cinema history. You know, I think sadistic killers and sadistic bad guys would become a thing. I don't know when Arch Hall, was it Arch Hall Jr.? What, the sadist? I don't know when that film came out. I don't know if it came out after this or before.
That would have been early 60s, I believe, 62-ish.
Yeah, so that film's like
taking, right after this, yeah.
That's like taking the bare bones of this film and making it bare bones for that, where you're just mean to be mean. And, you know, with the Tallman character, you know, I can see an actor nowadays. I can see, like, a Nick Cage playing Tallman. I could totally see him wanting to do that. Like, hey, look, Nick, we're going to give you a bad eye, and you can sleep with one eye open, and you're going to be as sadistic as possible. And I'd see him saying, oh, yeah, I'm all over that, man. I could see him totally chomping at the bit to it. But really, it's very interesting that it is so sadistic first time. And like I said, me and Todd, we covered White Heat, I guess, a few months back.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some similarities in the Jimmy Cagney character and the Tallman character, right? There's some similarities in that kind of sadistic bad guy.
Yep. They all tend to be a lot less tough.
Yes.
Than they put it out there.
Yeah, yeah. And White Heat, it was a mama's boy, and this one, he's a an abused kid, and who just a bully for all intents and purposes, never got his way. But get a gun in his hand, and all of a sudden he has the power. So it's a strange human trait, but it does exist, right? So, I enjoyed the movie. It's a fun watch, and this is the best I've ever seen it look. I've seen those public domain prints. They're pretty murky, but this is the best I've ever seen it look. So, yeah, good stuff. Let's kick it over to Todd for MVT's Make or Breaks.
Alrighty, MVT, I'm giving it to Lupino. She's as capable at this dark material as anyone could be, and maybe even more capable. So hats off to her. Make or Break is the shoot in the can scene. I thought it was amazingly intense, and it establishes the pecking order of these three characters pretty solidly, pretty handily. Score for me, I'm going 8 out of 10.
I was
impressed with this thing. It is lean and mean, and it works almost 100%. So, good job, kudos, and solid stuff. I would absolutely recommend this to folks.
Nice, with a little horsey sauce.
With a little horsey sauce, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man. I make a joke about that, where the horsey sauce is going. Oh, shit. Okay.
Those early internet porn days.
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah. Wet and wild. So my scene, my make or break is going to be the scene with Tallman talking about the watch. Why had a watch like that?
Yeah.
And he says, I had to take it, basically. And I think that sets us up to see what kind of character he is. He's not necessarily cruel for cruel's sake. He's been dealt a shitty hand, and he's been put upon his whole life. Now he's going to be any chance he can to be in the chair, so to speak. He's going to revel in it, and he's going to be a petty, cruel little man as long as he can. So I like that scene. MVT Lupino, absolutely. I agree with Todd. I think wrote the screenplay, directed it, made a tight little mean and lean film here with some really good stuff. The finale, I think that the location's great, but I just it's a little flat.
A little anticlimactic, right? A little anticlimactic.
Yeah,
it is a little bit.
Absolutely, but otherwise, yeah, quality stuff. One I never would have watched otherwise. I don't think. Not to say it didn't sound appealing, but it just, there's so many films out there, right? So sometimes we need our buddies to shepherd us through the cinematic valley. My score for this one's a 7.25 out of 10. Solid little film.
Nice. My make or break is also the can shooting scene. I really like that scene, Todd. That's a good call. It does. I like the intensity of it. I like the, again, if you want to take the kind of, the, homosexual kind of look at it. There's an interesting looks from the O'Brien character and the Lovejoy character in that moment of putting possibly a loved one in peril. But even if there isn't, I mean, you know, I mean, if you're tight with a buddy, you know, I mean, it's still not something you want to do, you know. But these guys are all ace shots, man. Let's just say that right now. I mean, they don't miss the can on any of those shots, do they?
No.
Yeah, they sure don't.
There's never a miss. I'm like, God damn, these guys are awesome. I mean, Jesus. And from what I understand, I don't shoot guns, but from what I understand, shooting with a handgun from that distance is, and hitting that can.
That's pretty inaccurate, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing how accurate they are. So, anyway, is what it is. But it is a nice little tense moment. I'm going to take my Sammy logic to the MVT. Here it comes. I totally agree with you guys with Ida Lupino, because I think it's lean, mean. I think she knows exactly what she's doing. I think she shoots it efficiently, almost like a Clint Eastwood-directed film. You know, it's just like it has very little filler sometimes, just like every scene is boom, 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 and it just keeps moving. Can't disagree with you guys on that at all. But when am I ever going to ever be able to give it to William Tallman again?
Never say never.
Yeah, I look through his filmography. Chances are pretty low that he'll ever get the opportunity to be a MVT on the G, not that it's a, you know, a trophy, but I mean, you know what I'm saying, but I do think,
for us it is,
but I do think that he is charismatic and interesting, and I really think he has the best part in the movie. He's the titular character. He's the most interesting pathologically. He looks great. And I think all those things he's asked to do, I think he performs very well. So I have to give it to Tallman in this case. I think it's a great heavy performance. Maybe one of the forgotten heavy performances of in cinema, in a lot of ways. And it's really, in a lot of ways, it's his movie. I'd say Edmund O'Brien was probably the star, but really nobody's a star in this. I feel like equal billing to everybody, but Tallman really is the one that stands out to me. So, yeah, I'm going to give it to him. And my score is, like, right in between you guys. It's, like, 7.5 out of 10. I really like this. I do feel, like you guys did, I didn't talk about it when I did my part of the review much, but I do feel that the ending is a bit anticlimactic. Like, either, one, they ran out of money, or, two, they ran out of ideas of how to end the movie. Because it does feel that way. And it kind of walks off into the sunset, and you kind of feel like, really? So there is a little bit of that, but I will not. But it still works. I just think that it's not the build. It's not paying off for the buildup it leads to. All the buildup before that, you know, it's in GGTMC shirt terms, bad money shot, maybe bad horsey sauce. So who knew that horsey sauce would be a big part of the show this week? Nobody. No.
That's going to stay, man. That's
including
us. The horsey sauce stays.
Including us. We had no idea. Just, oh, man. I'll never live it down. 7.5. So we got a 7.25, 7.5, and an 8. So that's pretty good. Pretty good. It's a good movie. And I'd like to cover more of her stuff. Maybe in the future we will. Mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to take a short break, come back, and discuss Rad from 1986. We'll be back right after this.
Taking a stand, you ain't gonna fall. You've always known.
That song to me, like, perfectly encapsulates like this genre of movies in a lot of ways.
Oh, and the era.
Yeah, I mean, because there's just like this genre of these youth movies that a lot of us grew up with. Of these, you know, up against it all, usually with some type of commercial thing like a skateboard or a bike or a
some
video
corporate
game.
Entity.
Yeah, some type of thing that we all buy or would like to buy. And it just makes me think of like, you know, Ralph Macchio and all these type of things that I grew up with, these kids movies that quote unquote I grew up with. So this is Rad from 1986, directed by the one and only Hal Needham, who you would probably know mostly from Burt Reynolds movies.
Yes.
And oddly, there is some Burt Reynolds actors in this movie. Some Burt Reynolds regulars. Probably, I guess at this point, they were probably Hal Needham regulars. But this is the story of one young man, Crew Jones, who has the intensity and the desire to win a BMX race called Hell Track. That's the plot synopsis on IMDb. I love it. The story of one young man. So Crew Jones, yeah. Bill Allen, who's still working today, off and on. He stars in the film. You got Lori Loughlin in here, who's been in the news lately for some questionable behavior. Talia Shire is in the movie, which I think the movie at the beginning, I think it's called Talia Film. Is she a producer on the movie?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Ray Walston playing his great character named Burton Timmer.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Hand does good.
Yeah, Mr. Hand's pretty awesome in this, and he gives two great middle fingers.
Of course, yeah, he does.
I love when people give a middle finger and it gets a little bit of a shake to it, you know, because that means you're really angry.
You're emphasizing, man. Yeah. That's caps lock.
It's caps lock. You're right. Alfie Wise, who, if you know Burt Reynolds movies, you know Alfie Wise. He always plays the same character.
Yes, he does.
Some little sniveling creep who's usually some type of crony to a bigger character. Jack Weston, who's also in some Burt Reynolds movies, and you've seen him in 1,000 things. And, of course, Bart Connor, famous gymnast, husband of Nadia Comaneci, and does a great job playing the well-to-do Bart Taylor in this. And let's not forget H.B. Haggerty as our bald, mustachioed cop.
H.B. Haggerty and Australian great. They could pass for twins.
Roger Ward.
Roger Ward, those two need to do a movie. They should have done a movie together.
Yeah, they should have. They should have. They really should have. I think H.B. Haggerty, wasn't he in that Jackie Chan American movie, I think, The Big Brawl or something like that?
Probably.
I think he played like a big boxer.
I haven't seen that in years.
Yeah, I think he
was.
But
I need to correct myself here. I was lying. Talia Shire was not a producer on this.
Yeah, it's so weird. I could have swore I saw something said like Talia Film.
It did say that.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, she was not, she's not listed as a producer.
Silent partner.
Yeah, right. Man. Yeah. Silent but deadly.
especially for Crew.
Yeah. So what's interesting about this movie is a couple things. There's some fun trivia to this movie. The twins, those guys would go on to write the Conjuring movies.
No fuck way. Out of here.
Yeah. And a few other things. If you look at their filmography, they became writers in Hollywood and they're still working today.
Oh, man, tell me you're going to talk about what the original title of the film was.
Oh, what would I didn't see it. Let me see.
The original title. I'll let you drop this one if you like.
I don't see it. I can't find it right now. So.
The original title of the film was Balls Out.
Oh, man. Well, there's that great scene where H.B. Haggerty says that, right? Think you're in the lumberyard, man. Go balls out, which is totally a homoerotic line if you think about it.
It is.
Act like you're in the lumberyard. Well, go balls out.
Maybe they
should
have called it ass sliding, right?
Yeah.
Ass sliding.
It's very bizarre because I'm sitting there thinking, oh, yeah. Well, I think I've been to a bar called the lumberyard before. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. What Rad is such a fitting title.
Yes.
This movie is so 1986.
It is. It totally encapsulates that era perfectly.
Like, you know, we were kids at this time. BMX, like biking, like, you know, bikes were life at that point. We didn't have the game consoles and things that kids nowadays do. I lived for riding my bike and trying to look cool on it. And one more piece of trivia that we both had said off the air, Rod and Rex's dance suits were borrowed from the movie V.
Yeah, because they
that's incredible.
They totally look like it, so it makes total sense.
Dude, they're the Tomax and Zaymot of shitty fucking BMX bike team riders.
What a great pull.
Yeah. And they're really good at playing these shitty twins because they stay shitty all the way to the end.
Yeah, they do. They totally do.
I don't know who wants to lead on it or if you guys want me to. I don't, you know, it doesn't matter, but
doesn't matter to
let's
me.
Let's get to talking about it.
Okay, well, I'll spit a few things here quick then. I don't know if you'd mentioned this, Sam, because I was pulling up the trivia as you were talking about it. This has never had a release. Did you mention that?
I did not mention that, no, but it is a very important piece of information.
Yeah, so this film has never had a proper release on any physical media format post-VHS. So it never had a DVD release, never had a Blu-ray release, and it's criminal.
It is.
There's so many, like this film is, as you're going to hear about, I'm going to just not clear my cards too close to the vest here. It's such a fun slice of 80s sort of Save the Rec Center, you know, triumph of the human spirit, teen movie. Like it's so, how it doesn't have it. And Todd and I were trying to pontificate about why that could have been a licensing issue. Who knows?
I think it had to do with all the logos.
The logos is probably what it is.
It probably has more to do with licensing than anything. I know that there's a bit in the trivia, too, about one of the songs in the movie didn't get put on the soundtrack. And it says on the trivia that the song is now forever lost. Yeah, it's gone. Like, and
it's crazy.
So there's all these little weird things about the movie. And the movie wasn't a massive hit. I think at the time it came out, I think people were starting to kind of get away. They were kind of heading toward that kind of big action movie star type stuff.
Well, you know, and I guess the thrashing kind of stole its thunder with like the whole skateboard thing. Because let's face it, bike tricks are a bit bulky as opposed to skateboards.
Yeah,
they are, and I think also too, this is as much as it's a fun, well-intentioned fad film. It is a fad film, right? So if you're at the bottom of that wave, there's going to be fatigue, and it was evidenced in the box office. It only did like 400 grand opening weekend, and
insanity.
I know it did 2 million worldwide gross. So it flopped. And that's a shame because it's got a fun director. It's got a really solid cast who I think acquits themselves well for the material.
Yeah.
You know, they all are pretty energetic and a pretty seasoned cast when you look at Shire and Walston and Weston and then the young faces who are all pretty earnest and likable or unlikable as they need to be. Fun fact about the GGTMC, we have featured 2 Olympic gold medalists on our show.
That's right. Yeah, it's true.
We get Mitch Gaylord and we get Bart Connor.
That's right.
Yeah, that's amazing. I got to say, I got to give it up to Nadia Comaneci. She is to the world of gymnasts what Edvige Fenech is to actresses. She is fine wine.
Yep.
Was Kurt Thomas...
Oh, yeah. We got Kurt Thomas, too.
Yeah.
What is it with our fixation with gold medal gymnasts?
Small, well-built. We really like small, well-built men.
Yeah, right?
Apparently so.
They got to be small, though.
Lean.
Hey, Stallone's small.
That's true.
He is.
Yeah.
Okay, so Needham. Needham's forte really is stunt work and sort of man and metal together and how man can manipulate metal in a way. The stunts in this and the montage is so well done and so well shot. Even if you're not really a BMX enthusiast, it's hard to not be impressed by what these riders do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really impressive.
It's almost pornographic, right? It's almost bike porn in a way, right?
It is bike porn.
It totally is.
Absolutely is. You know, the opening's pretty fun, too. Well, you know, I think Needham knows where the bread's buttered for this film in that sometimes we get fad films and they don't feature much of what the formula needs. What was the one we did? What's the Earth, Wind, and Fire film we did? It's named after a song of theirs. That's Life. What is it called? our friend Sean, Shawnee Rockets, programmed it.
Oh, shit.
That's The Way of the World.
Oh, there you go.
And that film didn't feature as much Earth, Wind, and Fire as it needed to, you know, as far as like musical numbers. But we've seen fad films that just don't feature as much. They don't go to the well as often as they should. And this one, thankfully, does go to the well as often as it should. The paperboy routine early on is good, but the grumpy neighbor, the dog, the fisherman.
You got the little extended montage scene, and you know it's supposed to be showing not only Cruz's skills but setting up the community. Yeah, like Ray Walston's the crank guy, and you know it's also setting up Cruz's little goals and the idea that he and his friends are like the blue collar outsiders with dreams of making it big and escaping their circumstances. It's that well worn 80s plot, polished with a ton of gloss. And by the way, I had a paper route as a kid. It is not as much fun as it looks in this movie.
They're on like he's on like a forklift.
I never did that.
The fire truck's about like you know they're all about the morning news. They're on the way to fire. The alarm's going on the truck, and he's handing it off. And yeah, it's fun. It's very fun. It feels very much like the audience it was made for. It would wish fulfillment. You know, you'd think about
Totally. This thing's pure fantasy.
Absolutely.
In so many ways.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and in that adolescent way that we all, the three of us, all kind of grew up with really liking, right?
Like, sure.
Like Karate Kid and all that kind of stuff. There's
absolutely.
That burgeoning realization of your sexuality, that, you know, falling in love, all those things for the first time, your love of something. I mean, there's a great scene here where he's like, the only thing I'm good at is riding this bike.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and she wants him to take his SATs.
That's right.
Kind of like in Some Kind of Wonderful, the only things I care about are me, my drums, and you, right? Yeah. Same thing.
Yeah. And I think all of us as young men or young women go through this phase in our life where it's like, you know, our parents don't understand us. Even if we think they do, we still rebel in some way and say, look, you know, the only thing I'm really – look, I really like this, and this is what I want to do with my life.
Well, here's the thing. Here's the thing about the whole does crew qualify for the race or take the SATs thing. You know, it's funny because it's set up to be like some kind of like drama, but the Laughlin character just simplifies it for us. She's like, you can always go to school later.
Which is true.
His mom kind of disapproves, but you know, hey, she comes around because of course she's going to come around. Well,
she disapproves because as a parent, and I know Will feels the same way too. As a parent, you think to yourself, yeah, there's always time, but. As a parent, you're like, yeah, just go ahead and get that out of the way because you can quickly, ever so quickly, that can slip you by. That can slip right by you.
Oh, big time.
Yeah, and you said, okay, I'm going to go to school later. And then a year goes by, and you keep saying it. And then 5 years go by, and you keep saying it. And then 10 years go by. And
But in the movie, it's just kind of like it's set up to be like some kind of drama, like family drama for the crew character. But then it's just kind of like blown off. It's just like,
Yeah.
You can always go to school later. Oh, okay. Well, problem solved.
What's great about that is there's a few moments when she turns on the TV and she gives that worried / disapproving look. And you know she was drawing from her Rocky experience. Like that
she
was
absolutely was.
That was Adrian, like, couldn't, like, watching through her fingers.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that was fun.
That was the moment when she realized she had to actually kiss Sylvester Stallone. She was like, his breasts smell like bologna and pickles. With horsey on it. With horsey on it. That's right. Yeah. You knew where I was going.
That's it. I'll tell you, Mr. Hand, as much as we want to talk about Walston as being sort of a lovable grump, a firm but fair man, he's not, crew did not earn any points by throwing the coffee, throwing the paper and knocking all of the fucking coffees out of his hand.
That's right.
I would have been hot at that, man.
I love the fact that he's riding a BMX bike too, though.
Yes.
Like he's like, there's a part of him that, like, you know, he's part of the, he's like, he's a hipster. He's even got the hipster hat on
and the tweed jacket.
He's hip. I just realized he's a hipster.
He is.
Right down to the facial hair.
Yep. Right down to the facial. We get lots of Kix cereal product placement, which they were being in the BMX scene, which is awesome.
Kid tested, mother approved.
It was.
Yeah, nice pull there, buddy.
I think it's kid-tested, parent-approved, but maybe it was mother-approved back then.
No, it was mother-approved.
Yeah, mother-approved, and I think eventually because of political correctness, it became parent-approved.
Parent-approved, yeah.
Don't want to leave the dad out.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Did it really?
I think it did, but don't quote me on that. Either way, I got to be honest with you, I'm not a fan of Kix.
No, Corn Pops is...
The berry ones weren't bad.
Well, yeah, because they're sweet.
You had to have sugar.
Yeah, yeah, the berry ones aren't bad. None of the berry cereals were bad because they bloated it with sugar, man.
Well, yeah.
Oh, sure,
that's,
sugar.
That's the joy, right?
Yeah, yeah. You got the joy. You know, you had the white milk that turned to pink milk. I mean, that,
yeah.
Ugh, what about,
who doesn't want that?
I can't believe, as an aside, speaking about cereal, like my kids, we try to eat them, have them eat healthy cereal, you know, Rice Krispies, Cheerios, Corn Flakes, stuff I hated as a kid. And they love it, thankfully. But I can remember getting Rice Krispies and taking like a tablespoon of sugar shaking it on the cereal. And you know that milky sludge?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Which
it's
I
like
think
mainline heroin.
You only took a tablespoon?
Yeah.
Dude, I fucking would unload on fucking Rice Krispies.
Yeah, yeah. I probably unloaded as well. It got to the point to where I was...
Unloaded, yeah.
Yeah, I was probably...
I don't know why I don't have diabetes.
It probably got to the point for me where I was probably sugaring sugar cereal.
Oh,
I'm pretty sure...
I never went that far.
I'm pretty sure I put sugar on Frosted Flakes. And you don't need to put sugar on Frosted Flakes. I do. I had it bad, man. I love cereals, man. Like if I had one food, I think I could live on the rest of my life and not have any health problems. I just have an assortment of cereals. I'm like Seinfeld that way. I just have like 50 cereals, and I just eat cereal all the time. I love it all. I mean, I love the really bad shit. I love the good shit. I love all of it.
Have you? Do you guys have Jordan's brand?
No.
There.
No.
It's good. Man.
No.
It's like a healthier-ish, like, you know, nuts and all that stuff in it. It's really good. That's too bad.
We have a lot of nut cereals here. Yeah, so.
Oh, yeah. Nuts.
Nuts and horsey.
Nuts and horsey together at last. We get the spunky, adoring kid sister.
Oh, yeah. With that drops the cuss words. That's always important.
She does drop the cuss words.
She's so precocious.
She is precocious.
She's not afraid to tell somebody where to stick it.
She is full of sass. And
she does have sass.
Somehow, I don't find her as grating as others I've seen. Like, it's such a well-worn cliche, but
yeah.
I don't know. I think everyone's pretty likable in this.
Yeah, they are.
In spite of, you know, being sort of well-worn area, or well-worn material. It's a bizarre choice to name her Wesley, though.
It is.
Yeah, right?
Wesley. It's an odd name for a lady. No offense to any female listeners named Wesley.
Yes.
I don't know.
If we have one, no offense to you, but not a common name.
No. Let's give it up to Bill Allen as Crew Jones. Crew Jones, right? It's Crew Jones?
Yeah, it's Crew.
Because I had always assumed he was a BMX guy, and he wasn't. Like, he was an actor who just... The stuff he does is believable enough. Like, you know, whereas with Lori Loughlin's character, it's clear that...
That's Eddie Fiola.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's very clear and a bit disturbing in moments that the dance sequence is... you can tell it's totally a gentleman with a wig on. It's a good old Eddie Fiola there.
But... Yeah, so, I mean, you know, Crew Jones, Bill Allen does a good job of that. Jack Weston is really fun as a sleazy promoter. He's lively, which is good.
He has some great comedic timing in this.
He does. He's a lot of fun in it, a lot of fun. Pound for pound, does this have the most uplifting, triumphant songs in a film, like, minute to minute?
It's up there with Rocky IV.
Man,
it's got to be, right?
Competition.
American Anthem, it's one of those. Yeah, so it's this was that era where these uplifting, like we talked about earlier, yacht rock type songs, I mean, they were all over the place. And this one is pretty impressive. I have to say, you're right. I mean, there's a lot of rah-rah moments with the music. A lot of hot licks. A lot of hot licks.
There is some really good hot licks in this one, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. BMX groupies. Crew Jones is so pure of heart that he turns down something delicious. As they say. Yeah, Crew Jones wants to know he's all about that Laughlin horsey sauce.
Back then, I would have been too.
Yeah, she was cute. She was perfectly cast. Like, she's cute, fresh faced. She's really good in the role.
It's really weird to me going back and looking at this how quickly she fits in with the community, though.
Yep.
It's like she's immediately part of the community.
It's true.
She's like in the school. She's like helping out, making the rad shirts and all this stuff.
I want one of those rad shirts, man.
Those rad shirts are awesome. They're so red.
Sorry, one sec, guys.
No problem.
No problem.
We'll talk a little bit about the rad shirts. They're almost not even red. They're almost like a, like a berry, like a berry cereal.
Yes, berry. You could have put them in Kix. Yeah,
could have. What else? So crew, yeah, the red shirts are great. Never underestimate the indomitable spirit and can-do attitude of a small town.
Yes,
never.
That's right.
It's amazing.
Dude, these guys stop traffic to help the lady with the cake in her oven.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's really that.
Well, it's an era that don't exist anymore, right? I mean, it's
precisely.
There's really almost doesn't. An Andy Griffith Mayberry quality to the town, and
or Capra, like Capra, yeah. By you know the way Joe Dante and I guess Needham, you know, is sort of a Capra-esque sort of transformed into the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. But it does. The movie makes you feel good. It's a feel good movie that way. It just makes you feel like everybody's on the same side. And,
absolutely. Yeah. What else do we got here? Not too much else. I love, yeah, I love the douchey crew with, yeah. What's his name there? Bart yeah. Connor.
Bart Taylor.
Bart Taylor, sorry. Bart Taylor and the twins. It's like the Cobra Kai, right? Yeah. He's like the Aryan yes. villain.
Yes.
Yes.
And I love the yuppie Yale aspiring kids at the front end of the film too. Yeah. That we see every so often.
Yeah, they're funny.
Yeah,
I will but say
they never really show back up, do they?
You know, a little bit.
I think one other scene.
Yeah, one other scene. I will say that the Bart Taylor character, I really like his arc.
Yeah, it's a good arc for
it's
sure.
It's a good arc. Yeah, I mean they could have made him one dimensional, you know, and they decided to make him a little three dimensional, and I really appreciated that.
Well, he is Billy Zabka. I mean, it's basically Billy Zabka.
Yeah,
he's a total absolutely. Jerk, you know. And then in the end, you get the Jack Weston character kind of becomes like Martin Kovask right before the Hell Track thing starts, right?
That's
telling good. The Reynolds twins to take crew out.
Yeah.
But you know, all the bad guys have. You know, first of all, they all have mad dance skills. And I'm going to put on my pig hat here for a second. Is it your opinion that the twins are double teaming that hooker in the blue tiger print outfit?
Oh, come on. Of course they are.
You know
they are. They're high-fiving while she's on the spit.
That's right. She's airtight and they're fucking giving each other looks.
Oh, yeah. The one last thing I want to say is...
Finger cuffs, the end, huh?
What's that?
Finger cuffs, huh?
Yeah.
How about Lori Loughlin's power stance on the bike?
Yes.
How about that?
That's got to be the MVT of the film. I mean, it's incredible. It's not, but it very easily could be. So that's it. I'll let you guys wax on this one.
Wax on, wax off. Yeah. I like the elements of the film. So I don't remember watching BMX racing and BMX tricks and stuff. I don't remember that much hopping. There's a lot of hopping on bikes.
There's a lot of hopping.
And I guess that's part of the tricks and stuff. And they're impressive. Don't get me wrong. I could never do that stuff. But, man, there's a lot of hopping. I was like, man, these guys. A lot of mullets in the movie. A lot of questionable hairdos. This movie is incredibly white. Going back and looking at it.
Oh, it is the most white bread of everything.
This might be, pound for pound, the whitest movie we've ever covered.
It could be.
Yes.
And I'm not.
You know, people complain about like Archie and that being so white bread back in the 50s. Dude, yeah. This thing puts it to shame.
Yeah. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying it really drew my attention, right? I mean, this one was shot in Calgary, Alberta. And they did a good, really? Yeah, they did a good job of hiding that, man. Like, it
they
doesn't.
Did.
It looked like
it was California.
Yeah,
for sure.
It looked totally like California, but it was all done in Calgary, up in Alberta,
or Oregon, or something. Wow, that's good for them.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of the kind of forestry scenes. I guess now I can maybe see it if I think about it. But really, even then, I mean, you got a lot of famous forest scenes in California. So I would have totally bought this as California. I didn't know it was shot in Canada at all.
No.
So it's interesting. Like you said, some of Needham's regulars show up in this. Jack Weston, of course. Alfie Wise is in here. I don't think Ray Walston was one of his regulars, but...
I don't think so.
But I know Jack Weston and Alfie Wise were. And I think Needham shows a really good hand at making a very simple movie here. Now, he made simple movies, Smoking the Bandit 2, Hooper, Villain with Kirk Douglas and Arnold Schwarzenegger. He made that. He did Stroker Ace, for lack of a better title. I enjoy it, but it's ridiculous. I think Jack Weston might be in it. No, I don't know if he's in that one. But anyway, Alfie Wise is in a lot of those. I know that. And I think it's interesting that Needham, I think, got better as a filmmaker. And I think this or maybe one other film after this was his last theatrical film. So I guess this was the bomb that kind of took him into TV movies. Mm-hmm. It might have been. And he kind of, I think, did some Bandit TV movies with Brian Bloom and some other stuff like that, which, you know, kind of wrote out the end of his career. But he did do Megaforce, you know, which we have never covered on the show, believe it or not.
Still have to cover.
Still never done Megaforce.
Silver beckons.
Yeah. Let's see, his run, Smokey the Bandit, Hooper, The Villain, couple TV movies, Smokey the Bandit 2, Cannonball Run, Megaforce, Stroker Ace, Cannonball Run 2, Rad, and of course, who can forget Body Slam with Roddy Piper.
Oh, amazing. Yeah.
And then
I forgot he directed that.
Yeah, then he just kind of, kind of faded off into the sunset, really, in a lot of ways after that, as far as theatrical films go. So, there's a lot of talk of ass sliding in this. You don't know what it is until you see it. And again, it's one of those things where it's part of the genre, slow motion, falling in love, doing something together.
Well, here's the thing. They call it ass sliding, but it's just basically sliding.
Yeah, it's just sliding.
It's just sliding. It's just oh so romantic, though.
Is it concrete they're sliding on, though? I feel like
it's like a concrete runoff that goes into the lake.
There's some bad spills in this. So a few dudes and ladies maybe.
Oh man,
take a few bumps.
Oh man, there's one when during the bike race. There's one where some dude face plants and he hits hard, man.
Oh yeah.
During the Hell Track race, I mean he really plants. He face plants hard. I'm really fascinated by this Talia Shar, this Talia Film Production Company, because I've been looking at it ever since we started talking about this movie.
Dude, they only produce like 4 movies. They're all like, what?
Yeah, they're strange movies too.
Yeah.
Anyway, I need to look into that more. Like I said, you know, both of our films this week are very simple. The formula pictures and they're straight genre movies, but I think they really work because of that. This could give you a cavity in a way. It's so sweet. I mean, this one is I'm really appreciative of the fact that it's got an overall rating of 7.1 on IMDb. The Metascore on Metacritic is 23, which is
ridiculous.
Criminal, because even though this movie is ridiculous in a lot of ways, I'll totally cop to that. There's not a bad bone in it.
No, it's pure of heart. And the thing is, like, it's pure of heart. And I think to Needham's testament, he's like, you know, sometimes when we see like breakdance films, they feel really tone deaf. Like it's a movie made about youth, but the people making it have no idea about youth.
Yeah.
This feels like Needham captured that moment in time well as far as fad films go.
Yeah.
Doesn't feel tone deaf.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't feel like, sometimes like go back and look at Breakin'. You go
Body
back,
Rock.
Body Rock. Or like I said, or Breakin'. You know, Breakin' I know has a soft spot in a lot of people's hearts, but if you go back and look at it, it's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
Not nearly as ridiculous as Breakin' 2 is. But, I mean, you look at those movies and you feel like they're made by exactly what they're made by. They're made by somebody from another country looking to rip on a fad. And that's exactly what they're made. This feels like it's made by an American filmmaker about an American fad, which is BMX racing, because that is a totally American fad. And, we all probably were part of it or wanted to be part of it maybe at some point. Or maybe we didn't. Maybe we hated it. But we all knew about it. I know for me growing up, you know, my mom and dad never had the money to buy the really nice bikes. But I always wanted one, right? Kind of like a fancy car. I always wanted the Mongoose or something like that. I can't even think of the name of some of the other bikes. I think I ended up with a Schwinn. But either way, I love my bike, you know. And I customed it up as much as I could. And it was, like you said earlier, it was my lifeblood. I mean, it was my wheels. It was my way of getting around. It was my social tool. It was everything. There was a different time, obviously, when you could stay outside, you know, from daylight till dark. You didn't have to worry about things like sunscreen all the time and all these other things. And it's a different time, but still, it's a romantic time, I guess. And bikes were kind of like the horses of their time in a lot of ways, for lack of a better word. I mean, some kids were very macho with their bikes. I remember that in the neighborhoods growing up. I don't know if you guys did, but some kids were very much show-offs with their bikes. They'd have fancy reflectors or they'd have fancy wheels. You know, I remember one kid had white wheels. I remember thinking, God, what this guy, is he a pimp? You know, what do you need white wheels on a bike for, you know? But, you know, you just tricked them out. You just did what you could because that was part of the culture. And, you know, that eventually turns into cars and women and girls, I guess. Maybe not women, but, it turns into all that. But I do think this movie really does wear its heart on its sleeve, and I think that's one of the best things about it. Now, let's talk about this because we have to talk about it. Will didn't talk about it much because I think he got a little bit distracted. But, well, yeah, I know he can get into on this conversation now. This movie has maybe the most ridiculous dance sequence in the history of cinema.
Oh, yes. Listen, and by ridiculous.
That thing is nothing but slow-mo, sweet love-making via bike dancing.
Yes.
And fog machines.
It is soft. And it's almost like De Palma shot it, that soft gel.
It is. Yeah. And yeah. And there's actually a lot of that sort of thing. Like, there's heavy use of that red sky filter going on the outside scenes. But going back to the dance sequence, holy shit.
Yeah,
it's a lot of fucking slow mo.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And let me ask you this, dude. Okay, so Crew goes nowhere without his bike, right? It's really kind of obnoxious.
Yeah.
Hello.
I think we lost Todd for a second.
I think that's the BMX gods smiting Todd.
Todd dropped out. We'll have to wait till he comes back and to remind him that. But
don't fuck with Crew Jones. But I guess we can continue on with the bike talk. But it's so audacious. I mean, but it works because I think if you're going to go for it, swing for the fences, and you're trying to make a world that don't fuck with the bike gods, Todd. You've done it now.
He's Skyping us. The fuck? He can't hear you, Todd. He can't hear you. We know you're there. But you messed with the BMX gods, man.
That man, yeah, they don't play.
So now we're
switching. Am I there?
There you are. There you are. You're back. So we lost you.
Am I back?
Yeah, we lost you like right when you started talking about the dance sequence.
You started talking shit about. I'll tell you, Todd. The BMX gods don't play.
They don't. I'll tell you.
Gone. It was like the trap door opened up from under Todd, man. Yeah.
Where was I?
I can't remember.
BMX bikes were great.
Yeah, and you were talking about the. You said Crew never goes anywhere without his bike.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, and it's really kind of obnoxious. And like, if he came into your school dance with his bike and just started tooling around, like, wouldn't you be kind of like,
who's this, irritated by
him?
Yeah, who's this asshole? That's what I'd be thinking.
Yeah, right. You'd be like, what the fuck, man? I'm trying to bust a move.
Yeah, get off your bike for a minute, man.
Dude, I got a chick here in tiger print pants, and you're fucking around in a fucking puppy.
But then, the key to this scene is, I agree with you, but the key to this scene is, then he makes Jaws drop. He appeases the BMX gods.
Jaws and unlike pants.
You, Jaws, I would say Jaws and panties.
Yeah. Unlike you, Todd, he appeases the BMX gods and does a dance sequence with Lori Loughlin. Well, actually, Eddie Fiola dressed as Lori Loughlin. And...
which is really just so fitting for
And they do a dance sequence on BMX bikes. That's the newest cereal coming out there.
BMX
bikes. They do this dance sequence, and then my jaw hits the floor because I'm like, how was this ever a good idea?
Yeah,
this is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Now, saying that, and I said this before we started reviewing the films today, it's both the worst idea, and thank God they did it.
Yes.
Because it exists, and it forever will hold a spot in my heart as one of those moments in film history where it's like, thank you for doing this.
Well, I think it's like it's kind of like how in martial arts movies, the martial arts sequences are kind of like dance scenes in musicals. Yeah. And then this is like the equivalent of the martial arts scene being the same thing as a dance scene, but in a fad sport movie.
Yeah.
That's... Yeah.
It's crazy. It's crazy. But it plays out well, too, the scene, we should say.
Sure.
Dude,
if you take away nothing else from this movie, you have to take away that scene.
Yeah.
Well, precisely. And, listen, don't play it safe. Go for the swing for the fences. Would this scene have been as memorable and joyous to people if it was just a conventional, like, slow dance scene?
No,
not even close.
I don't know, the Bart Connors dancing would have been memorable. That's absolutely terrible. Some of the worst dancing I've ever seen.
This side of Crispin Glover.
Oh my God, it's bad. Bart Connor, you know, bless your heart. You might be an Olympic gold medalist, but you are not. Whew, you were not John Travolta on the dance floor, bro.
No, no, you sure ain't.
Not even Frank Stallone.
Oh, my God. No. No. He wishes he could be Frank Stallone.
Yeah, right.
Oh, we all.
Apollo Sorrentino. I always think of Apollo Sorrentino when I think of Frank Stallone.
Yeah, right.
they seem like Sorrentino seems like the lost love child of one of the Stallones. One of the Stallones, you know.
Oh yeah.
You see him and stuff. He got a cigar in his mouth, and he looks like a Stallone. Anyway, neither here nor there. But that scene alone is worth the price of admission if you've never seen this. And it is. I agree with Will. It is criminal. In a way, this is one of those movies that even after doing the show of 11 years, it's hard for me to believe somebody hasn't figured out a way to get this thing out officially in some type of format, like DVD.
Yeah, I'm really surprised that Shout hasn't fucking tackled.
Oh, yeah, that seems right up their alley.
It does. Yeah, right? It does. It just seems like there's so many great stories behind the scenes about this movie. It seems like there's an audience that would definitely purchase this movie. It's really just a shame that it's not more readily available. It's not even readily available to watch on YouTube. It's tough to find on there. You can find bits and pieces of it. Mm-hmm. So you do have to go the bootleg route to watch this movie. And, to me, shame on the studios when it comes to stuff like that. Because, you know, make it available in some way, you know.
Yes.
And they'll say, well, it is available on VHS. Well, let's get real. You know, people don't, not everybody, maybe film buffs have their VHS players still out. But people who just are going to watch films occasionally, they're not going to have a VHS player.
No, and it deserves to be seen. We got an HD boot of it, a rip of it. It deserves to be seen in that. I mean, the 80s was a colorful time, and it's a colorful, bright film. I don't want to see a muddy VHS just for the sake of it.
Yeah, it's been shown on a few channels in HD. I can't remember the channels it's been shown on, but... I know at some point, did Todd drop out again? Is that why I'm getting Skype?
No, that's Lori Loughlin.
Oh, nice. I like that.
By Lori Loughlin, I mean Eddie Fiola.
Yeah, Eddie Fiola.
Yeah.
He was super popular when I was a kid, man. That's a good-looking bike.
He was the Don, man.
Yeah, that's a good-looking bike, though. I like that bike.
That is a nice bike. The mag wheels.
Yeah, yeah. What was I going to say? Oh.
Sorry, dude.
No problem. The bootleg I watched, as a matter of fact, had an advertisement for the channel that it got ripped off of.
I think I know. Yeah.
So I don't know which one. I can't remember what it was, but it was like, you know, but I'm sitting there thinking bravo to them for. So that tells me that if it can be shown on a channel, chances are it could be released, but maybe there's just some kind of murkiness to the legals behind it and stuff. But it's one of those weird films that just hasn't really kind of crossed over into modern physical media, and it's there's still quite a few of those left, and this is one of them. So I'm gonna kick it over to Todd, let him throw in a few things about Rad.
Alrighty, not really a hell of a lot left to say here. I think that when when he does race the local bike cop is when it really kind of sinks in that the film is just a lark, right? It's only intended to showcase some bike tricks. This thing's light as a feather with a little underdog story anyone can get behind and a little tiny bit of romance. And that's really, that's the beauty of this thing, right? It's got some nice stunts courtesy of Needham. And that's really, you know, just about all it needs aside from that skeleton sort of plot that you get to it. So I think that, dude, when they were in the drugstore, I had to pause for the shot of the comic book rack.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Did you do that?
Oh,
nice. Dude, Alpha Flight number 28's on there. Last issue of John Byrne. Come on.
Nice.
Give it to me.
Alpha Flight, also a Canadian superhero
team. That's right. That's why it was there.
Right,
no,
man.
I'm kidding. I think that, you know, so we get to the big race, right? To be perfectly honest, I didn't find it all that exciting. And I don't think that the score quite sold it either. When we got to that piece of the movie, if I'm being 100% honest about it, everything else up to the race, you know, was fun. And of course we need the race, obviously to finish it off, but, didn't quite stick it on that one. And then, you know, after the dramatic kiss and makeup scene between Crew and Bart, I was thinking to myself, where the hell is the sequel to this? And of course, you know, there wasn't going to be one because it flopped, but at the same time, dude, how fucking awesome would that have been? Crew and Bart.
Oh,
taking on the world.
It'd have been amazing.
Oh, yeah. Man. They could have taken on, they would have taken on like some
some breakdancing crew.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what they could have picked. Some international, like some
Japanese
and French or Russian.
Yeah, some Russians. Yes,
Russians had engineered the perfect bike.
That's right. They did. All those evil Ruskies. So, I mean, it's a charming film then and now, I think. You know, aside from nostalgic feelings, you know, Bill Allen actually manages to be magnetic enough. There's nothing heavy about the movie. You know, sure, it stops entirely for the bike sequences. It's like a musical, again. But that's just playing to its target audience. And that being said, I don't think you have to really like bike racing to like this.
No.
Because I wasn't as into bike racing as everybody else was. I mean, I had bikes, but I never got into it nearly as much as some other people did.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously, you don't need to have that. In the same way that you don't have to be into karate to like The Karate Kid or to be into boxing to like the Rocky movies. So there's that. And, I mean, aside from that, I think we've pretty much covered everything that I can think of.
One piece of information to Talia Films. So Talia Films, I did a little detective work by way of Google.
Lusso.
So we were on. Yes, exactly. That's accurate. So Jack Schwartzman is the man behind Talia Films. Of course, Jack Schwartzman was the husband of Talia Shire.
Ah, there we go.
So, yeah.
So he named his company after his wife.
After his wife. That's right.
There we go.
Produced Never Say Never Again, Rad. Peter Sellers' Jam, fittingly. Yeah, so there you go. But it's funny.
Yeah.
See, now the bike gods are happy.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So that means that Schwartzman, that's Jason Schwartzman's dad, right?
Correct.
Yeah, yes. There we go. We're getting it all together now.
Yes.
Those damn Coppolas.
That's right.
They're all over the place.
For real, man.
Is that everything done? You gonna do the make or breaks now?
Yeah. So make or break. Come on. We're really gonna fuck with this. It's the dance scene.
Yeah.
Send me an angel. Slow mo. Gel right. Lens. Yeah. Power stance from Lori Loughlin. Incredible. Just to have the guy swing for the fences. That's a grand slam. That's out of the park. MVT. I am gonna go with, and this is the cheat of, you know, the cheat one. I'm gonna go with everyone involved with this production because I think that Needham does a good job deferring to BMX experts and allowing sort of youth culture to shine through in a kind of a make great way. I think that the cast and Eddie Field and everyone else does a great job. I think that Sammy's playing my jam right now.
There we go.
I think that everything works and gels in this film to make it a great slice of 1986 nostalgia. Clear-eyed, sunny-hearted nostalgia. Damn. My score for the film is, again, for what it is, a 7.75. For what it is, it just ticks off the boxes. It's fun. It's great.
Yeah, that's great. Obviously, you're right. The make or break is... I may have hurt myself by playing the song. Yeah. Turn it up a little bit. Here we go.
It's hard to be lucky in love. Hard to be lucky in love. It gets in
your eyes. And you got to think about it.
Horsey sauce. It gets in your eyes.
Yeah. Ooh, man. You don't want horsey sauce in the eyes. I tell you what. You just think of smoky... There you go. There we go. Arm flourish. If it was a video podcast, we'd have this down. Yeah, man, I remember that song quite a bit. All right, anyway, back. Let's get real here. Come on. You're right. The make or break is the dance sequence. Just because you'll never see anything else like it. You just will not. I mean, I just don't. I mean, I imagine there probably is in the history of cinema quite a few dance sequences that are just like, what the hell's going on? But this one is just, I think the craft of it, the originality of it, the idea. Like, you know, you got to think, you know, when people are making movies, there's hundreds of people around. Hundreds of people probably agreed this was a good idea.
I know, right?
And it's like, really? I don't know. I don't know if that's a good idea, you know? And I just get this image of how Needham going, no, I'm telling you right now, this is going to sell bikes. my MVT for the movie is Needham. I actually think this is, out of all the films he's directed, it's not my favorite because I love Smoking the Bandit. I love Hooper. I love Cannonball Run, Cannonball Run 2, Smoking the Bandit 2. I love a lot of those movies. But I think that this is one of his best directed films because he doesn't really kind of get sidetracked. This mm-hmm. this one kind of really stays to the story, and it's very simple and it's very well done. I think it's very well shot. I think, you know, thinking about what Todd said about the race at the end, I think the Hell Track is cool until you see it in practice. And then once they go down it one time, that wall. Now, yeah. Again, I couldn't do it. I'll be forthright. I'll be the first one to face plant off of that wall. But once they do it, you're like, yeah, it wasn't really that big a deal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's what it felt like, kind of, you know.
And then they do it like five more times.
Yes, yeah. It's like, yeah. But some of the racing in parts is really good. And you start to pick up, because of Needham's kind of ability to shoot action, you kind of start to pick up the kind of geography of the course and everything. And it's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Man, I'm going to go high on this one. I know this might sound crazy, but this movie made me feel really good. It hit a sweet spot when I needed it. And not that I've been down lately or anything, but I didn't feel great this weekend. And I just needed you know, some piece of bubble gum to make me remember sometimes why I love movies. And this was the one. So I give this thing an 8.5.
I'm going to go 8. I felt very – yeah, it's got to be an 8
That is
for
some
sure.
Chud level – scoring, yeah. You're giving
it's
me
so
that.
Good for what it is.
For what it is, man. You can't, for me, you can't argue that it doesn't, like Will said, it ticks all the boxes. And
I think it
works perfectly. I like the townsfolk. I like Ray Walston's character a lot. I like the heavies because they're ridiculous and sort of funny.
Tomax and Zama.
Tomax and Zama. They totally are.
One's
and
just it, missing a scar.
And we didn't talk about it much, but like I said, those guys went on to write quite a few motion pictures. But The Conjuring being probably one of the biggest hits they've written. And they, you know, obviously they wrote that not too long ago. So I don't know. I didn't mention exactly what else they wrote. Did you guys see anything else in there that?
GGTFC. I didn't get a chance to look, that's crazy. They wrote this. There's so much fun trivia around this film.
Yeah, the GGTMC fans would love. I'm just going to look real quick before we get off the air here, because why not? You know, we'd love to bring up these little things. Where are they at? The Hayes. I think they're called the Hayes brothers. Yeah, Chad and Kerry. Rod and Rex, which is great.
Rod and Rex. Chad and Kerry's more of its time, I think.
Offa and Sika.
So there you go. They've written. No, they're still writing stuff. They're writing Journey to the Center of the Earth 4, whatever. The Crucifixion, Conjuring, Whiteout, The Reaping, House of Wax screenplay for their remake. They did that.
Really?
Yeah.
Which is better than it had any right to be, in my estimation.
You know what? You're right about that. That was better than it had any right to be. Just some fun stuff. So they're working. Bravo to them. And they work together, evidently. So they're staying tight after all these years. I wonder if they write in their V-suits.
I hope so.
Yeah,
I hope they have. I'd be making love in the V suit, man.
Nice. All right, I'll kick it over.
Thinking
to Todd.
About Jane Badler.
I'll kick it over to Todd for MVPs and make or breaks.
All right, so make or break. You know, I kind of wanted to go with Crew versus the Cop in the Lumberyard because I think it shows just how lightly this thing is meant to be taken. But I gotta agree with you guys. There's no way it's not the dance sequence. There's no fucking way. MVT is I'm going with Bill Allen. I think he's nice. A likable all-American boy who makes you want to root for him. I mean, if he was a bigger, just a little bit shittier, a little bit more egomaniacal or something like that, or was a little less unassuming, I think that he might have not been able to work in this situation, but I think he did. And score for me is, I'm going to go 7.5 out of 10 on this one.
That's good.
Yeah, dude, this thing is still, it still ticks all the boxes for me. I still love watching it. It's nice and smooth and shallow and fun and everything that it needs to be. And plus, you get the guy who Crew works with, Bob. Right, who looks just like Seth
Blob.
Rogen.
Yeah, Blob.
Not Blob, you smartass. Yeah. He looks just like Seth Rogen. So, just pointing that one out.
Yeah, he has a great moment where he steals some lady's popcorn.
Yeah, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know that guy. He's my friend. Yeah, man, but rad. Definitely worth a look. And unfortunately, like we said, you probably have to bootleg it to see it. But
yeah.
It is worth a look. It's a lot of fun. All right, that's the big show for this week. We almost hit our goal of 8 o'clock, Will. We only missed about 40 minutes.
That's how we do.
That is how we do.
Come on. We weren't going to talk about something cool, you know, Ida Lupino doing something as a trailblazer and then get into, like, 80s glory and not go long and strong.
That's right. Next week, we are going to be sponsored by Diabolik DVD. Todd programmed a show that's... has the potential to be one for the ages here. Yeah. He decided to take two different sides of the European director, auteur helm here. We'll be doing Bob Le Flambeur. Is that how you say it? Bob Le Flambeur.
Yeah. Yes.
1956.
That gambler.
Yeah. From Jean-Pierre Melville. You guys may have heard of him. Easily one of the most influential filmmakers of all time. And in another regard, another influential filmmaker, we'll be doing 1984's Murder Rock.
A.K.A. Giallo a Disco.
Yeah. Also, Murder Rock / Dancing Death, I think, is
yes.
the...
Yes. Yeah.
So that's directed by Lucio Fulci, who...
Come on, man. What a GGTMC episode you guys program.
Yeah. We have covered... We may have covered everything. We're going to force over with. We're going to get Lucio Fulci completely knocked out.
Yeah, and if you'd be the first director.
Yeah, and if you told me, because I'm not the world's biggest Fulci guy, but in the lifetime of this show, I have come to appreciate Fulci more and more.
Yes.
Because we have delved into his filmography, maybe deeper than any other filmmaker we've done. And I don't know how that's possible. That wasn't part of the game plan. But thank God it's happened. I mean, he really did. And maybe dud is the appropriate word sometimes, but he really did make some very GGTMC-esque films. And he is certainly a GGTMC-esque director, no doubt about it. But so is Melville.
So is Melville, yeah.
High art / low art, maybe? Definitely. We're going to be talking about that, so... All right, that is everything. So we hope you look forward to that. We hope you go out and check out The Hitchhiker. It's on the Criterion Channel, and we hope you find some way to check out Rad. Please do. We think you'll enjoy it. With that, I'll say adios.
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 Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at ggtmc.com, and you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com. Thank you.